Welcome back to the SCBWI podcast. I'm your host, Theo Baker, and on today's episode, I had the great privilege of talking to librarian and writer John Hsu, aka Mr. Hsu. If you don't know him, John is on the road hundreds of days a year, spreading his passion and advocacy for reading to young people across the country. And now he's out with a much-acclaimed middle-grade novel in verse, Louder Than Hunger, a fictionalized account of his experience living in residential facilities as a young teen with an eating disorder. Please be aware that this episode delves into the topic of disordered eating. John's book and the way he talks about it treat the topic incredibly responsibly and with great care. But if you're sensitive to this content, I recommend listening with caution or support, or maybe even skipping the episode altogether. I talked in depth with John about his new book, about finding that voice, and about remembering trauma and figuring out how to depict it in verse, and about just how in the world he formatted all that concrete poetry. We also got into his advocacy and literacy work, and what he knows about storytelling, which is plenty. I hope you enjoy. I've always wondered, where does the name Hsu come from? I just would love to ask that question.
Well, actually, my legal name is not John Hsu. I often say you cannot pay John Hsu because he cannot cash a check. But my legal name is John Schumacher. And in 1999, when I was an elementary school major, my very first clinical experience was with 3 and 4 year olds, and they really struggled to say Schumacher. And so on that day in 1999, I became Mr. Hsu. And then I slowly transitioned from Mr. Hsu to John Hsu. And I much more identify with John Hsu than John Schumacher. A few weeks ago, I ran into a friend from childhood, and they called me John Schumacher, and it didn't feel right. But I knew that they knew me from that time in my life when I went by my real name.
Yeah, the alternate John Hsu. Tell me a little bit about, you've just released your first novel in verse, Louder Than Hunger. We're going to get to that in depth, but just tell me a little bit about where you come from, and you can answer that any way you want to.
Yeah, so Louder Than Hunger, as you said, is my debut novel in verse for middle school readers. And the main character's name is Jake Edward Stacy, and my legal name is John Edward Schumacher. And so Jake and I have the same initials because I am Jake and Jake is me. But I wanted a little bit of distance from my childhood, a little bit of distance from my adolescence, and I didn't want to write a true memoir. And so I changed my name, which allowed me then to fictionalize parts of my life. So I think Louder Than Hunger is told in 5 acts. In act 1, we open in the year 1996, and Jake Stacy is in the 8th grade. And you can feel right away that he's spiraling out of control. And there's a voice in his head, an inner saboteur, that's really, really loud and really hateful and convincing him that he doesn't deserve to live. And so Jake's pretty much stops eating. And then in Act 2, he's hospitalized for anorexia nervosa, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, and anxiety. And then in Act 3, he goes home and he fails miserably. And in Act 4, he goes back to Whispering Pines, a residential psychiatric facility. And he starts to finally heal after many trials and tribulations in the last act of the book.
So tell me a little bit about, I'd love to just get a little, because you're a reader first, and I'd love to talk a little bit about novels in verse with you.
Well, thank you for saying that I'm a reader first. So I do a lot of school visits. I did 220 school visit presentations during the 2022-2023 school year. And I love that when I go to middle schools, often the news will, like the student-run news organization will interview me. And recently, 6th graders interviewed me, and I don't remember what the question was, but this is what I said. I said, when I come to your school, I'm wearing lots of hats. And they thought I was like physically wearing hats. So I had to explain like what that meant. And I said, the first hat is always, I come to your school as a reader. And I'm really, really comfortable wearing that hat. And then the second hat is that of a teacher. I was a 3rd grade teacher for 3 years, a 4th grade teacher for 1 year. And then the third hat is the hat of a teacher librarian. I was a teacher librarian for 9 years. And then the fourth hat is writer. And all of those things, hat 1, 2, and 3, helped me become a better writer and helped me become a more critical listener.
I'd love to kind of just hear your take on novels in verse, because it's sort of a recent thing that's, you know, it wasn't that long ago that like some of the first ones for kids really started to come out.
So novels in verse. So yes. When I was an elementary school major, I worked part-time at Barnes & Noble. And I loved working at Barnes & Noble. And when I worked at Barnes & Noble, I discovered a book called Love That Dog by Sharon Creech, which was the very first novel in verse that I ever read. And I remember reading it during a shift. I was supposed to be shelving books, but instead I was hiding in the children's section reading Love That Dog. And I read so many books when I was supposed to be shelving books, but that's another story. And I remember thinking, whoa, this is fun poetry. This is exciting poetry. And I was immediately drawn to the white space. And I loved how some poems were short and some were long. And I especially liked that they didn't rhyme. And I was a kid who was like obsessed with A Light in the Attic and Where the Sidewalk Ends and Jack Prolutsky and so many other really fun collections. And then something happened as I got older. Poetry became a chore. Poetry became so much work. And I fell out of love with poetry for a really, really long time until I discovered Love That Dog, which then led me to Out of the Dust and led me to so many other books. So there weren't as many then. This would have been like the late 90s into the early aughts. But then I feel like graphic novels exploded, but yeah. Novels in verse like graphic novels really exploded like maybe 10 years ago. I mean, especially when the crossover by Kwame Alexander won the Newbery Medal. I mean, Out of the Dust also won the Newbery Medal. That was the first novel in verse to win. But yeah, I love novels in verse mostly because they're often highly accessible. They're often harder topics that are easier to digest because of that white space. And also you can skip around more in a novel in verse. And I tend to live in a stream of consciousness. And so novels in verse as a writer was a really good structure as well. Because I feel like it really mirrored my brain.
Absolutely. And you're talking about the white space and having that space for the reader. Because as I was reading your book starts off, all right, we're feeling it. We feel it immediately. There's darkness, a black hole, something pulling down the voice. But then we have that white space to kind of say, all right, I see this kid's in trouble. I see this, but there's a kind of, and then you start playing with the text and there's like fun things that you're doing. And just tell me about like, I'd love to hear.
So much. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I'd love to hear about how you started playing with it, because you're also working a lot with moving the text around, working vertically, different sizes.
Yeah, it came out just supernaturally. Like it came out a lot like my own speaking voice. And again, the way my brain works and the way my brain tracks things. And I often show Jake's anxiety by moving words across the page and by giving sometimes a lot of space in between stanzas as a way to show my own like anxiety sometimes that I feel as an adult, but especially as a child. Up until that point, I had only written picture book manuscripts. So I think I used a lot of picture book techniques in telling his story as well, as far as the pacing and the page turns and how text would become bigger and smaller. And almost I was trying to create art through the way that I laid the text on the page. And Candlelick, my publisher, was so wonderful to allow me to have a novel in verse that's like 520 pages. And they allowed me to use the space that I needed. They could have said, no, you can combine poems and you don't need all this space. But they saw that it was important to understanding Jake's brain and a lot of his, you know, inner struggles.
Yeah, I think Candlewick is a great home for it because they do all those books with like Eugene.
Candlewick.
Yeah, Eugene Yelchin and oh my God, I'm blanking on her name.
Who Kate she wrote? Camilla?
Yes, Kate. Yes. Yeah. My God, and she just did that new illustrated novel, and they use space and design and layout so wonderfully. And it's a great home for this book, this project.
And thank you for mentioning Kate DiCamillo. She wrote the foreword to the book, which was like such a beautiful gift. Often when I talk about the book, I read the foreword. I think the foreword is like encapsulates so much about it. And it's the perfect book talk for the book. And I get to read somebody else's words.
That's always a nice thing after you've spent years with your own.
Tell me about, okay, so one of the things that I was most impressed with, you're like, I'm using picture book techniques. But one thing I noticed is the presence. You're so present in every scene as you're right with Jake's every tap of a pen on a paper. Oh, he feels it and you feel it. And tell me about like capturing that immediacy of the moments when he's feeling everything at the same time.
This is what really helped me. So most of the book was written in New York City. It was specifically written in the Marriott Marquis at like 46th and Broadway. And this is how I opened myself up. It's going to sound kind of woo-woo, but every
Go
day
for it.
I would leave the hotel and I would walk to the Bethesda Fountain in Central Park. And when I was walking, that's like a mile and a half, I would be doing a lot of pre-writing and I'd be like opening up my heart. As KT Camilla would say, I was trying to open up the suitcase of my heart. And then when I would get to the Bethesda Fountain, I would do a lot of writing. Like I would like poems would just flow out of me and I would speak to the angel. And because I spent so much time next to the angel ended up becoming a character in Louder Than Hunger. Because the book doesn't take place in New York City, I had to like create an angel in the town where he lives that's like modeled after the Bethesda Fountain. And so I think a lot of it was like the angel, the presence of the angel, the energy of the Bethesda Terrace. I just feel like a lot of spiritual energy there. And I think that's truly what helped me do what you asked, to have that immediacy, to open myself up, to be fully present on the page, because I did a lot of work in order to open myself up. Like it was hard and it was painful. And my editor is Susan Van Meter, who's a brilliant editor. And she said to Jasmine Warga, who's actually my neighbor, well, we live in the same neighborhood, but in presentations, I always say, Jasmine Warga is my neighbor. And then in presentations, she says the same thing, but she lives in my neighborhood. But anyway, Susan Van Meter said to Jasmine Warga that in order to write Louder Than Hunger, John had to turn his heart inside out.
Yeah. Like, how did you, and I would just, as a follow-up to that, like when you're dealing with difficult material like that, and it's difficult material that you've had to actually deal with as a person.
Yeah, I live.
What kind of like self-care were you just beating yourself over the back with a whip?
You know? Thank you for asking that, because I didn't know if I'd ever share this publicly, but I've now shared it publicly twice. So it's something I'm going to talk about, and it's the truth. I really struggled with the fourth draft of the book. I ended up being 6 drafts. I thought it was going to be 5, but the fourth draft was really hard. And in order to write the fourth draft, I had to go really, really deep into my past. And I started to do some of the behaviors again. And I immediately wrote my editor and my agent. And I said, I'm writing really good poetry, but this is affecting my own health. And so I took a break from the book. I started therapy again to help myself, not for my own, like, struggles with anorexia nervosa. I would say I'm on the other side of that, but other people's trauma that they're sharing with me, I have to figure out ways to not carry it then with me everywhere, and that it thereby affect my own mental health. But I was writing really good poetry, but at the expense of my own health. And so I was grateful to have 2 wonderful people in my life who said, of course, you need to take a break.
Well, poetry can do that. It can cut deep. Like when you're really on that edge of creating something, there's a little bit of death in it, you know, and there's a little bit of, and especially when you're accessing, I thank you for mentioning that. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, just to clarify, I didn't go into it. The thoughts were there.
The thoughts.
And it was scary. And the thoughts came so that I could write the poetry. And I'm like, no, I don't want to go that deep in.
The old friend, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, because it's there.
There's a presence.
It's there. I mean, it comes. I've realized that almost everyone has some form of the voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to talk about the voice, which I think is one of your, which is a real triumph of this work, is that voice, because it really captures something adolescent. That we all have that voice, and we all have varying relationships with it. Sometimes it's not there. Sometimes it's controlling everything. But there's something very adolescent about it, especially the loneliness of that early adolescence when things are changing and you feel spiraling out of control and you're like, who's here to help me? And then then a weird voice. Tell me about like artistically how you started to work with that voice.
Well, it was it was the voice I heard right away. Cause I mean, I know the voice so well from adolescence. And the book used to start in what I call act two, which is when Jake is hospitalized. And act one, like the first 100 pages didn't exist until like probably what I think of as the second draft. That's before it got to my editor. And I realized like that was like just too intense. So the voice, like you came right into the voice with such intensity. Whereas the way it is now, I feel like I ease you a little bit more into the voice. But the voice is what I heard right away. I heard that like really, really loud, shouty person in your head that tells you that you're like, you know, an awful person. Because I know as an adult how I overcame that. And so I was able to go right back into it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I answered that, but yeah.
No, we're not going to answer anything directly. You know, we're going to circle around, and that's all. That's that. If you could have answered these questions, you wouldn't have had to write the book, you know.
Exactly. And I'm still figuring it out. Like, I learn things all of the time about myself in the book every time I talk about it.
What I found really interesting too is that we didn't have a long time of watching him, of Jake, spiral down. We get this. He's reflected in other people. Blind person can see there's a problem.
And that really happened. I would volunteer when I was in the seventh grade. The book starts in eighth grade, but for me it was actually seventh grade. I went to a school that was only from 9 a.m. until noon, and then you were expected to do volunteer work in the afternoon. And so every Monday through Thursday, I would volunteer at a nursing home, and I loved it because I loved working with the residents, but two, it was an easy place to hide, and I didn't have to deal with other people my own age. And I was always like more precocious, and I always identified more with adults than I did with people my own age, which is interesting now as an adult who works mostly with children and like really bonds and, you know, sees into their heart and soul. But that's another podcast episode. But there was a lady who was a retired teacher, and I wish I remembered what her name was. And she was legally blind, and I would read to her, and she started to sense that there was something wrong with me. And she's the person that went to the director of the nursing home, and the director called my mom. In the book, it's Miss Burns, the lady that I read to, called, but in real life it was the director. And it was because of the nursing home that I ended up being hospitalized.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, and I think artistically it's really effective. Just that little, we don't see the behavior. We don't see the maladaptions forming. We don't see what led him to want to exercise all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Really, tell me about that, those choices.
And I was very, very protective of Jake when I was writing the book. But by being protective of Jake, I was being protective of the reader. So in a book that I wrote called The Gift of Story, which is about the affective side of the reading life, I write this sentence. I'm going to quote myself. I write, books can be the perfect prescription to let us know that we're going to be okay. And when I was writing Louder Than Hunger, that was always written on a post-it note or written somewhere where I could see it, because that was always my guiding light, that anything that would perhaps help somebody learn how to have an eating disorder, therefore not being the perfect prescription, did not belong in the book. And so I never say how much Jake weighs. I don't go into food actually very, very much. I don't go into his physical description at all, because it's really not important. We know that he's sick enough to be hospitalized. We know that he uses a wheelchair, but I didn't want to use numbers in a way that would affect somebody, either if they've overcome an eating disorder and it was triggering for them, or if they were kind of experimenting with having an eating disorder, and then I would teach them how to have one. So a lot of the care in the book is that I am hoping that I don't help a reader develop negative behaviors. And when I was meeting with editors before it went to Candlewick, if an editor ever asked me to add those things, I knew they weren't the right person for the book.
Well, that's I'm so grateful to hear you say that, because I know a lot of people who are, 'cause right, these kind of disordered eatings, they come to you, you're alone with it. And you're like, you look for kind of, how do I do this? Right. And so I know some kids will look to like kind of like after school specials that say like, don't do this. Yeah, and they're like, oh, this is how I do it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, the voice was there. Like it was, you know, I was starting disordered eating, and I won't name specific things because again, I'd be leading potential people to resources, but I would spend so much time at the library looking up specific keywords, specific people like Tracy Gold. I would read anything I could about Tracy Gold because like her eating disorder was in the media at the time. And I learned how to have a better eating disorder, which is a terrible thing to even say because of that. Or there's a novel that I don't think belongs in any collections because that novel I read over and over and over again. And I would just do all of the behaviors of the main character.
Yeah. And the heart is there. And something that becomes very apparent very quickly for reading this is, you know, I've heard somebody say this once, and I don't even know, but they said the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety. The opposite of addiction is other people. And I found that really deeply in your book okay, he's alone with his disorder, and the world is knocking on his door saying, we're here. Like, but you're going to have to say yes to us. And that's a hard, that the other people and other books and other Emily Dickinson's there and other people. Tell me about like that process and putting that into fiction.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that at all?
No, I do. And that was really hard. It was really hard for me at first to create a character at Whispering Pines, the facility where Jake is, that he could connect with. And that's where Kella comes in. And Kella is the character that Jake finally develops a friendship with, trusts her. But for a long time, I kind of fought having a character like that I fought my editor on that. My editor comes saying, we need somebody else in Jake's life. But I was resisting that because in my own treatment, they tried to keep the eating disorder patients apart because they would teach each other behaviors and they would teach each other how to have a better eating disorder. And so the solution was for Jake to bond with somebody who wasn't in the eating disorder program. And we don't know exactly, we know Kella's there for depression. She's probably bipolar. And Kella then helps him kind of like come into himself in so many ways.
I would love to hear, this is kind of a craft question because you mentioned six drafts. I know after a couple drafts, right, it's kind of... You've gotten it out. That's exciting. And then there's some kind of dryness where you're like, okay, I got 500 pages of poems to edit. Tell me about those.
Yeah, they were all overwhelming. But I knew that I could always do it because Susan Van Meter was a very good guide and she was very patient. And she, I don't know, she really took care of me because she cared so much about Jake. And I refer to her as my fairy godmother in the acknowledgments because she very much acted as one. And each draft through her notes allowed me to uncover something I didn't know about myself, about the story, about how I wasn't writing a memoir and it was okay to make things up, because that was hard for me at times because I have a really, really good memory. And, you know, I remember the truth. And so when I need to change the truth, I feel like I'm lying to myself and not being truthful to myself. And so I just had to allow myself to lie. And once I would allow myself to lie, each draft would be easier. And the turning point for me and when things started to go a bit more easier was when I brought in the musical Into the Woods, because Into the Woods wasn't always there. Into the Woods came in, I think, the third draft. And I realized how many parallels there were between the musical Into the Woods and what Jake is experiencing in Whispering Pines, and that it's called Whispering Pines, which sounds like it could be in the musical Into the Woods.
Ooh, I did put that together, but now it's obvious. And that almost not quite a wraparound thing, but there's a touchstone in Into the Woods, right? Right, that has its own energy and is. And tell me about like learning to lie about your own, you know, because I know I get I can I can imagine this, is that you're like, all right, I have this real feeling thing that happened over here. And did you feel as if that you were dishonoring that, or?
Yeah, the feelings are all true. It's just creating something that didn't really happen in my own, because again, I know I'm not Jake completely, but I identify so much with him. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes struggle to call him Jake when I'm talking about the book, and I start calling him John, you know, myself. Because I'm so connected. So the emotional stuff is all there. It's just incidents. Like my favorite scene in the book is when they go to a bookshop called Unabridged Books, they meaning Jake and his dad. And he just has like this heart opening moment in the bookshop and in the neighborhood. And I had that own experience in the neighborhood on a day pass once with my mom, where I was like, I want to live in this neighborhood. Like, I feel so at home here, but in order to ever live here, and again, I was only 14 then, I have to start getting better. Mm-hmm. And it was a turning point. And I did move to that neighborhood when I was 21 years old. And it was like, okay, you now have truly come to the other side. And so I was able, though, to imagine, like, what would I have liked to have happened to me when I was 14, like in that bookshop? Mm-hmm. I know that's not making complete sense, but that's where it became exciting. Like, no, this is exciting to lie.
Yeah,
I'm not really lying. You know, I'm not lying because it happened to Jake. It just didn't happen to me.
Well, you could give yourself something that you didn't.
Yeah, have. It was like a gift to myself.
Yeah. And I you know, just from an artistic point of view, one of the things I found really fascinating is, you don't really examine it at first. We talk about, you know, the dad's kind of not there, and the mom we know is sad and has this,
yeah.
You don't pathologize it, but we can feel,
you
know, this big feeling that fills the room. And we kind of know where a lot of Jake is getting this from, is this, you know, like, yeah. Tell me about like how you dealt with, just artistically and craft-wise, with the parents, because we don't meet the dad for a long time, and we barely meet the mom, but we feel this kind of overwhelming presence of pressure.
Yeah, writing mom and dad were the hardest, you know, because they are my parents, and you want to protect your parents. And in early drafts, we knew a lot more about mom, and we knew a lot more about dad. But I felt like I had to pull back a little bit. And I really had a hard time creating parents who weren't mine. I wanted that to be truthful to my own experiences and growing up in a house with a mom who was very, very depressed and a mom with a lot of anxiety. And my mom is still alive and she won't listen to this podcast, I don't think. But if she is, hi, mom. I'm really nervous about my mom reading the book. I don't know, again, if she will, but how she'll react to that. And so I tried to protect my mom as much as I could, you know, in the book. And I think the way I protected them was by having them be a little bit less present and have the grandmother be more present in his life. And in my own experiences, I would live with my parents Monday through Thursday, and I would live with my grandma Friday through Monday. And that is true. And I did that, like, you know, for my whole childhood until my grandma died.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And, you know, hi, mom. hello, mom and dad as well, if they're listening. You raised a good kid and a fine writer. Yeah, no, I really loved the feeling her presence without knowing too much. Because, right, you don't want to, I know that you're working from a certain, like, I don't want to give away the store, but we get the structure of the relationship.
Yeah, and I think you really get it. There's a line in the book, I think this is the final line, where Jake's mom says something to him like, I know I'm the mom that you didn't want. And I think that is like a really telling, and Jake doesn't say, no mom, you're not, you know, that's not true. Like, he just he lets her say it, and he kind of like accepts it and acknowledges it through his silence, I think.
We've been talking to librarian and writer John Hsu. If you want to learn more about his work, check out johnshu.com, where you can also look at his picture books, This is a Story and This is a School. Okay, let's get back to part two.
This is like a super nerdy question. I want to get real light here. Okay. You're dealing with poetry, which is basically text art, concrete poetry, all over the page. I work with Microsoft Word every day. I work with a million different other word processors and text editors. They do not like what you've done. They rebel against it.
Trust me, I know. It was so hard for like the designer and the copy editors and the proofreaders. It was a mess.
So what are you doing? What are you just using the space bar and tabs? Like how are you composing these things?
Yeah, well, the entire book was written in Google Docs. I mean, every draft was in Google Docs, which would made an even bigger mess when it would be downloaded. And like, I mean, like so many people, I mean, looked at this book, right? And I still like in the final copy, they're going to be fixed in the second edition. There are issues with the spacing. And we're just going to say that was intentional. Like John wanted that space that way. I didn't. It just was like so messy when it would get downloaded. And then when I would see like proof pages, there'd be all these spaces that didn't exist and things would be on the wrong page because they would dump it the way it exactly looked in the document. So yes, it was a mess. And if I write another novel in verse, I'm going to set up my pages very differently. I'm still going to use the page probably, but I will set up my margins and I will set up the whole experience for the designer in a very different way.
Yeah, I just imagine the designer, because you know that there's a designer who's like going, all right, is this five spaces or six?
Oh, I know.
One, two, three, four. And I just don't understand because I just know I spend my life upset with the word processing, whatever it is, because it's always wanting to move the margin. Oh, you wanted this 15 characters in, I'm going to move you back. But how were you able to be? Yeah, how well? I'm just wondering how you were able to be spontaneous in that way.
It just came out of me that way. Yeah, it just did. And I just like used the page and lots of spaces and moving things around. And it was fun. It was creating art, but it was not. I mean, I'm sure I made a lot of people unhappy for many days.
I just had to ask that because I've tried to do that.
Yeah, no one has ever asked me that. So I'm grateful you did.
Because I feel the pain of everyone involved, and especially right. You get back a draft. You're like, oh, I did this 4 months ago, and I needed to have nine spaces here, and then you've forgotten. Well, all that short-term memory's gone.
My editor Susan Van Meter and I spent almost 4 hours one Sunday fixing all of the spacing issues. And her daughter kept coming and saying, "Mom, it's Sunday. It was actually Mother's Day. Why are you still working?"
We're editing saying, white space over here.
Yeah, I kept saying, "Susan, I'm so sorry." She's like, "No, John, you're going to make my Monday so much easier tomorrow."
I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, the gifts of story and just a lot of your work as a librarian and as an advocate for reading and not reading because it does X, but reading because it does everything. Just tell me a little bit about, I'd love to just kind of hear how you got, for those of our listeners who don't know, just how you got hooked on books and hooked on story and hooked on literature.
Yeah, so I became a reader mostly because of movies. So I grew up in a town where my aunt owned the video store, and I love talking to kids about video stores because it's so complicated. But a lot of kids know Blockbuster, I think, because of a Netflix show or a Netflix movie. But anyway, because my aunt owned the video store, I could just go in the morning and take home three VHSs and watch them all and return them. And I wanted to read books that were based on favorite movies. So as a kid, I read the novelization of Oliver and Company over and over and over again. I loved it so much. Eventually, fell to pieces. I was very close to my grandma, and we would go to the Jewel Osco grocery store every Saturday, and you could get a new book there from the Disney collection. And those felt like movies to me, where Goofy's Big Race was one in particular that I read over and over and over again. And so I say, like, I'm a reader today because of movies. And I think I loved reading novelization so much because I already knew the characters and I already, you know, knew the basic story, that it felt really familiar. And my favorite thing about novelizations was when you'd see that you were about to get to like the full color stills, like the screenshots from the movie. And I would like wait until I got there in order to experience it. And it would make me so, so happy.
I've never heard anyone say they got into reading from reading novelizations before. And I think that's amazing. Not just because I've done some novelizations.
Well, and I knew you did. And I didn't say that because I mean, as I'm starting to answer the question, like, oh, he's going to really like this because I know you've done novelizations.
And I love movies and I love just kind of trash and, you know, any way that a kid can get started reading I started reading from reading baseball cards. You know, we're always looking for that for kids, that door. You say, okay, Junior, time to replace the internet. We got something better than the internet. We promise. We promise you it's better than the internet. It will be, but like it's how to get the kids into those.
Yeah. And I don't like when people look down upon them, which is why I always like, I mean, you know, in front of 400, 500 educators, I love saying, I'm a reader today because of novelizations, and like I'll still read. I mean, I still read novelizations. I love them.
No,
so maybe you'll say I'll write one.
It's they've done the hard work for you. You just get to fill in the blanks. You know, the story is the hard part.
Yeah, and so really that was for me, that was my entry point. The gift of story that you mentioned is all about the affective side of reading. And so I wanted to write a book that was like about not the academic side of reading, but about sharing your heart through story and how you can do that. And so I create a framework called the affective elements of story. And so very quickly, there's story as healer, story as inspiration, story as clarifier, story as compassion, and story as connector. And in each chapter of the book, I define what that means. I do the research that supports like why this is actually true. There's always a guest author in each chapter. And then in each chapter, I write about 10 books that like evergreen titles that relate to that affective element of story. It was the hardest thing I've ever written, but I am so, so grateful that it exists.
Oh yeah. Nonfiction. There's no, it's like, just going uphill the whole time.
Oh, you know, yes.
There's no downhill.
Yeah. Yeah. But Terry Thompson, who was the editor of that book, was so wonderful. And I turned in the book 2.5 years late. And so he was very patient.
Well, tell me, I'd just love to dig in just a tiny bit more on the concept of affective side of reading. And just tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that, just for our listeners who haven't read the book yet.
So the way that I came up with this framework was because of something that Kate DiCamillo once said to me. I love Kate DiCamillo. I think she makes the world better. I think she makes the world brighter. I was on the Newbery Committee that named Flor and Ulysses the Illuminated Adventure, the 2014 Newbery Medal. I always loved her work before that, but I developed more of a friendship with her because of my work on that Newbery Committee. And one day when I was working at Scholastic, I worked for Scholastic for 6 years as the ambassador of school libraries. I was working on a presentation for the headquarters, on 557 Broadway, which I know that's not the address anymore.
No.
But I was working on a presentation for Scholastic, and I didn't feel like I was the right person for this presentation. And so I wrote Kate DiCamillo for advice, and this is what she said. She said, you were born to do just what you're doing, sharing your heart through story. And in that moment, I realized that through a text message, Kate wrote my philosophy of life. She wrote my philosophy of librarianship, that every day I get out of bed and I say, on this day, I'm going to share my heart through story. But I didn't fully understand what it meant to share your heart through story. So I wrote an entire book to like tell you what that means. And is what I realized by asking more than 500 people to finish the sentence starter, story is dot, 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 that we all look at story in a different way. And we all define story differently. And then I took all of those responses and I sorted them into categories. And that's how I came up with those affective elements of story. And after I did that, I created a Venn diagram where I put, I'm getting very technical now. I created a Venn diagram where in the middle, I put sharing your heart through story. And I realized in the other two circles that we have the academic elements of story on one, you know, which are the things that we often do in, you know, in English class and in language arts. And on the other side are the affective elements. And where they overlap is how you share your heart through story. So it's taking the academic elements of story and the affective elements of story and combining them.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, story is such... No, because it's so nebulous. You talk to everyone and they're all like, they'll say, it's about the story. And you're like, well, okay, is the story the plot? No. Is the story the metaphor? No. Is the story what happens? Not really. There's the stories, this kind of, it's the thing that makes it good or makes it worth, makes you feel, you can't, it's hard to define, but you know.
It is. Then that was where I was stuck. And then that's why, when I first started writing the book, I'm like, okay, I need to get input from lots of people. And the book that I ended up writing was not the book that I proposed. Mm-hmm. It kind of like found my way into creating this framework. And it really resonates with adults and it resonates with kids. I didn't expect to talk about the affective elements of the story as much as I do during presentations with children. But I always say to them, I thought I wrote this book for your teachers, but I really wrote it for you. And then I go very like kind of surface level through each of the academic elements of story. And then I always find a teacher in the room who I think their heart most needs a copy of The Gift of Story.
Well, so you've worked so much with kids and dealing with kids on their level and what they're really looking for in books and stories. And, you know, and you're not faking it. You're not saying, oh, you know, what kids need is a high-minded this. Yes, they need all that. But what they need is to get reading. And so what do you think, like, a kid is looking for when they go to open a book? And I'm talking about maybe a nine or 10-year-old kid who's independent and it's not mom, dad, grandma, or whatever, saying, okay, time to read.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are looking to connect. I think, like, for me personally, all my work comes back to that word connection, like to connect, how to connect. I think that's the common theme through all of my books. And when I'm working with children, I work really, really hard to identify which child. And again, I'm just meeting them now, but I can kind of like see into their hearts and souls, which sounds so like woo-woo again to use that word a second time, but I wrote a whole book about it, The Gift of Story. But I find like that kid who I think is going to connect most with this story just based on my observations of them. So in my opinion, a lot of kids are looking to connect. They're looking to be entertained, right? They're looking for joy. But that for me, like the novelizations, I was already connected.
Yeah,
with the characters. And so that's what I look for. I know that's not what all kids look for, but I think a lot do.
But they're friends. They were already friends, right? Yeah. Already friendly with you. And I'd love to talk about your picture books as well. We have This Is a Story here. And the other one is This Is a School. Tell me about coming up with the picture books and working with Lauren Castillo. And who's wonderful, by the way.
Oh, she's amazing.
Yeah, just tell me about like This Is a Story. I know my kids love to kind of look through it and say, I know that book.
I love. There's so many Easter eggs in that book. So I wrote This Is a Story first, but This Is a School came out first. So This Is a School came out in 2022, and This Is a Story came out in 2023. I sold This Is a Story in the year 2018. And I waited and I waited and I waited for Lauren Castillo because I knew, and my editor, Karen Lotz, knew that she was the perfect illustrator for the book. And I'm so grateful I waited. So I want to talk a little bit about like the inspiration for This Is a Story. Molly O'Neill, who I first met when she was an editor at HarperCollins, saw me at an event once here in Naperville where I live. And she saw how I interacted with kids and she could tell right away that I was like a natural storyteller. And so after that event, she reached out to me to see if I was interested in writing. And I said, no, I'm not interested in writing. I don't have stories in my heart. And then a bit of time went by and then she reached out again. And then she would reach out like, you know, once a year to see if I was now ready. And by that time, she'd become an agent, and she is now my agent. But the reason I signed with Molly O'Neill was because of Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Mm-hmm. Amy Krauss Rosenthal is who I dedicate This Is a Story to because of something that she said in a StoryCorps conversation with her daughter, Paris Rosenthal, that was released the day after she died. Mm-hmm. And in that conversation with her daughter, she says, make the most of your time here. And when I heard that, I said to Molly O'Neill, I am going to make the most of my time here by finally opening up my heart and telling stories. And This Is a Story felt like the most natural first thing for me to write, because it's my love letter to story, and it's my love letter to libraries and books. And I wrote it in honor of Amy Krauss Rosenthal, who I think did that, you know, through her entire career, where she connected people through story and brought people in Chicago all the time together by doing social experiments in the city. So that's how This Is a Story came. And then This Is a School came because I sold 2 picture books to Candlewick and I didn't have an idea for a second one. And so I said to my editor, Karen Lotz, what if we created a series called This Is a dot, dot, dot. And so I submitted 10 ideas to her and she liked This Is a School. And so that's how that one came, because like I know story and I know school really, really well.
Yeah. And one thing I was curious about is you're talking about that transition from avid reader and avid oral storyteller to write. Okay, time to write. And yeah. I'm, you know, being a reader, I remember when I first started writing, because I'd read so much and everything I'd ever read, I had this like beginner's just ocean tide. And it was just like, whoa. Because I'd never thought of myself as any sort of writer, because I had every English teacher in the world that said, you're terrible. And then when I'm like 23 and I'd spent 6 years just reading with my nose in a book for 24 hours a day, whoa, all of it just came out. And I was like, wait, okay, I get it now when they're saying you need to read to be a writer.
Dude,
there was nothing. Tell me about like when you first started putting, you know, when you said, okay, I'm going to pick up my writer's pen today. And tell me about those early experiences with that.
Yeah, I think so much, and I try to not always have my librarian brain awake. But I said I was a teacher librarian third, but because I read so much and because I'm trained as a librarian and because I teach in the School of Information at Rutgers, so I teach people how to be school librarians, I always think about like, how can a librarian use this book? How can a librarian use this story? And I always put myself in the space of a school library, especially when I'm working on my picture books, of how will this work in that setting? And so I think when I write, I place myself directly back into a school library. And I think about always like my former students and how this would work with them and how it would resonate with them. And sometimes that backfires though, because I'll see somebody reading, I'll hear or view somebody reading aloud one of my books. And I'm like, they're not doing it the right way. And I'm like, no, John, that's just the way you would do it. They're doing it the right way. They're doing it the way that they think it should be used. So I think like always being in the space of a library surrounded with children when I'm writing really, really helps me.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way to look, because I mean that's who's putting
the and often I write. Yeah. I often write things to where I think they'll fit into my school visit presentation. That's really where This Is a Story came. I used to have the kids turn and recite like a poem I would make up on the spot to their teachers, and I'm like, it would be so great if I had a picture book that I could read in this spot. And strangely enough, I still just make up a poem in the spot, but I now have imagery from This Is a Story going by on the screen behind me. And so I'm hoping they're connecting the two together.
Fantastic. Last question. All right. You get up. You're a very busy, busy individual. What's motivating you? What's pushing you out of bed to kind of be on the road a couple hundred days a year? And that's a hard life to be moving around so much.
Yeah, what really motivates me is most weeks I meet about 2,000 kids, and it is so exhilarating. Like I love standing in front of 400 kids who I've just met, and we go on this journey together through story. And there's these moments of connection, and I'm reading them and they're reading me, and you know, like we're connecting. And when I leave there, I'm often like physically tired, but I'm emotionally really, really happy and really satisfied. And it is like the biggest gift for me. And some would say, well, then why don't you just go back to, you know, your school library? I sometimes miss having my own library and, you know, the same students, but I feel like in the role that I'm in now, I can reach more students, and I truly get to do the part of library science and the part of teaching that brings me the most joy and fulfills me the most and feeds me. And the only other time I feel like that is when I'm in the theater. Like I know musical theater really well, and I know children's books really well. And the two are the things that bring the light and love into my life that allows me to create and allows me to, I think, better understand myself and humanity.
Thank you for that. I mean, thank you. The work you do as a librarian is so important, because it's such a, it can be the last thing like a city government thinks of. They're like, oh, well, the library, you know, like they it can feel to the powers that be so non-essential, but my God,
so essential.
But my God, that's where everything starts is, you know, in a storehouse of books.
When you were speaking, I was thinking of something that Pam Munez Ryan once said. She once said, school libraries are a safe haven, often for the student you least suspect. And when you take away that safe haven for that student, you are doing such an evil deed.
God, I know. Is there anything I want to make sure that we cover Louder Than Hunger? I think we talked about it.
Oh, no, I feel you did.
Lot.
Yeah, no.
I mean, like,
I want to make anyone else ever has. So thank you.
Oh, I read the books, you know, and I thought it was intense and lovely. And
I appreciate that so much. It's hard. It's a hard book to put out. I love talking about it, but I have to feel safe. Mm-hmm. And thank you for creating a safe space for me to talk about it. And I realized in some presentations, I hold back some because I don't owe it to everybody in the room, right? I don't have to tell. I don't have to become that vulnerable. But if I feel really safe, I can go to a part of vulnerability that I didn't even know I could. Because I feel like I could just open up my whole self. But I know in order to protect myself when I have to hold a little bit back.
No, I mean, conserve yourself, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I hope we covered it with the depth and the clarity that it deserves. It's a major work, and thoughtful work. Is there any final thoughts you have? If you don't have any, that's okay.
Yeah, no, what I'd love to say is just thank you to everyone who's listening to this podcast. I know a lot of teachers and teacher librarians and aspiring writers and seasoned writers are listening. And I just thank all of them for, as KHD Camillo says, of sharing your heart through story and for putting your, you know, your thoughts on the page and your heart on the page. And I firmly believe that when a school librarian or a teacher or somebody puts a book that you've written in the hands of a child, that they can tattoo love and they can tattoo light and they can tattoo joy on the hearts of the reader through what you've written. So thank you to all the writers. And I love SCVWI. I've presented at the conference in Springfield, Massachusetts twice, and both times were really, really wonderful experiences.
That's all the time we have today on our program. On behalf of all of us at SCBWI, I'd like to thank John for making the time to talk with us. If you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe to our totally free show and leave us some stars, if that's how you feel. And please head over to scbwi.org if you want to learn more about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. This episode was produced by Chelsea Kimiko Hall and edited by Samantha Thomas. And this podcast is made possible with support from the Authors Coalition of America. Thanks for listening this week, and we hope you'll tune in next week. So long.